Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. We have done away with long-suffering co-host Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork.
He's back from Iceland.
You've heard the voice of producer extraordinaire Dan Vadeboncour. We have replaced Justin with a guest from a sister podcast, competing podcast. Dr. Jonathan Ball from Writing the Wrong Way is here. And what we're going to do today, dear listener, is we're going to fulfill the promise of the premise of this podcast, and we're going to talk about how genre gets made. For context, and if you are a completist, we'll put links to those episodes in the show notes, our other episodes. We have been working around an idea called the Meat House, and Dan has made it his own and has gone on a little journey as a writer-creator to do something with it. So why don't you give us that context?
Yeah, so we came up with this at FanQuest last November. Myself, you, Justin, and Steve Kostanski, who's done Psycho Gorman and The Void and a couple of different awesome horror movies. And we brainstormed.
And worked on my favorite episode of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Yes, he talked about that. That was fun. He talked about melting faces. Anyway, we just story broke Meat House, what became Meat House, and it was just as we do, we've done it a number of times on this podcast. You can hear it below. And so I kind of took that idea and just went with it. What if it was I wanted to learn about screenwriting. I've been very engaged in film and television for the last couple of years. I think probably brought on by the pandemic, we all kind of jumped into something, and I really got into that. And then of course I'm also posting about it on TikTok, but I'm also a writer. I would get paid to write for a living as a journalist at CTV. And so it's not the same kind of writing. It's a very different kind of writing. But I would very much like to start writing the way you guys do, writing stories, writing creatively, and not just writing facts.
To learn, do.
To write the wrong way.
No.
Oh, no. Yeah. What were you going with?
I was saying to learn, do.
Okay. So do not. There is no try.
Our advice to you was always, if you want to write screenplays, write some screenplays. Yeah. And if they're shitty, amazing, because then you'll learn something having written them.
And actually, if you're coming from a field like journalism, like a professional nonfiction writing, and you want to move, say, to fiction writing, screenwriting is a great transition piece, because really the stylistic skills you need are the same. You want clarity in descriptions. You want condensed, everything's got to be condensed and clear. Just like in a newspaper article, say. But then you're adding on to it, of course, storytelling, which, is the thing you can pull into other medias in all sorts of ways. But what's nice about screenwriting, I find, and what I really like about screenwriting, is it's so focused on narrative structure, and it doesn't in many ways matter what the words on the page are as much as the structure of the story. So it's a nice way to learn how to make a better story without getting wrapped up in how do I make this, description of an apple sound good?
Right, right.
And an important piece of that is that the screenplay is not the literary document. It's not the final step.
Right, it's not the final product, right? Yeah. You're going to be getting a movie or a TV show out of this. It's not going
to
be...
And as a result, it's much easier to be sparing with your own praise,
right.
Feeding your own ego. You can just say, that's not as well written as I might like it, but it does serve the purpose of this moment in the plot.
And you guys have been great with keeping me motivated on this. I have, it's been difficult. I will admit, I definitely have gotten sidetracked and not had the motivation or focus. And I find myself continuously being pulled away from this as I want. Like, I do think about it. Sam said something last episode that I thought was really interesting when she talked about a lot of the work of writing is not actually writing. It's actually thinking. Mm-hmm. Right? You're thinking of what you want to write. And that's what I've been doing. I've been thinking about what I want to write. So what I would like to do is vocalize it here and then have this so I can kind of use it to jump off of. And we actually had a lost episode. So Jonathan and I have been going through this on Writing the Wrong Way. We have a couple of episodes up there you can listen to. And we have a lost episode that for some reason didn't record. Do you remember that? We did one on Zoom.
I wonder now if I've got it recorded.
Okay, well, if you do, then we'll post
it.
But well, maybe we'll come back to some of the stuff we talked about in that one, because I feel like there was some stuff in there that really helped me, actually, as far as the structure goes and as far as how to introduce characters. But should we just go through the story? Is that what you want to do?
Well, you began this by saying, okay, here's some things I want to do with this. And then Lyndon shouted from the from the cave we placed him in, don't give instructions now, wait for the podcast, so that people listening can benefit from the idea of, if you're wanting to share creatively with a writer's group or a group of first readers, it can be really important to explain to them what you need them for.
Okay.
Our job is not simply to say, good job, Dan.
Unless that's what you need, maybe.
Sometimes no, I don't want you to say good job, Dan. I just want you to be... So what I was saying when he said that was, resist the urge to suggest things.
Okay.
What I'm saying, right? Because I think that in a room like this with a bunch of creative people, you guys are just like, oh, this is awesome, and then we can do this and this, and you want a story break, but I just want you to kind of listen, and there will be... I'm sure there will be places where there are holes, because I haven't thought about all the details, but I just kind of want to run through and identify where those holes are and where I need to kind of really focus. And then I will, and by the way, still do Jonathan's method of what was it you had? You had those the beat sheet. We were doing this Snyder's beat sheet. Those things that really worked well. I've got that stuff. I don't have it in front of me, but I just thought, let's just go through the whole thing, and as much as I can bomb it out. What do you say? You know what I mean? I just want to get it out in my head onto the recording and then go from there.
Okay, so for a person who this is maybe their first episode, dear listener, what we're going to do is we're going to run through a story that we have brainstormed before and we have some context of, but we're not going to ask or interrupt as we might otherwise do for Dan to extrapolate.
You can
until
ask clarifying
after.
Questions. I think it would help if you asked me clarifying questions, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe at the end, though.
Yeah. Because I think, like, what I'm looking for from you guys is just, like, to view this as, is this a good story? Is this a realistic story? Like, question it the way you would question any other thing that we've been, like, we're just criticizing Ahsoka, you know, like that kind of stuff.
You were criticizing Ahsoka. Yeah. I don't criticize things I haven't seen.
That's right.
Here's the beer. Hope we haven't missed the beginning.
Well, no, but I really didn't bring you over here to watch a movie.
You didn't?
No.
So, I've come around to a couple different ways to begin this, but I really come back to the idea of a prologue. I like the idea of there being like a scene to set the scene, to set the and you're talking about the opening image of the film. So we're going to start off in the 1930s, and we're going to see a man, a drifter, hop off of a train. He's just been riding the rails. He's just been like, he's just kind of moving from town to town. He doesn't really have a place to go. He's just seeing where life takes him. He gets off the train and he wanders into town, comes across a rooming house, and it has a sign out front and says some kind of quaint looking rooming house. It's a boarding house where people can stop and stay for a couple nights and then move on. But he doesn't have any money, so he goes and speaks to the owner and says, you know, I and we don't necessarily see this on screen. We just see them talking or see a montage or something. And he asks for, he said, I can do work around here. I can, you know, I can do dishes. I can clean. I can fix up your thing in the back. I can work for my stay. So can I stay here for a few days? He says, sure. So he sits down and he stays, and you see a montage of him helping out, and they're you know, he's helping him with the things around the boarding house. And then at the end of the couple of days, he's getting ready to go, and he's like, you know, thank you very much for letting me stay here. I really had a great time. It's been a great time. And they says, oh, where are you off to next? And he's like, oh, I don't really know. I don't have a lot of I don't have any family. I'm just kind of wandering and seeing where life takes me. And he's like, oh, that's good. And then the guy turns around and bashes him on the back of the head and then throws him in the basement. Because that's food for the meat house. Because anybody who does not have ties to anything is food for the meat house. So that has how we open. And then we probably have the meat house like logo drop or something like that. And then we fast forward to 1988, when we have our main character. So that just kind of establishes the meat house in its heyday of this is how it's operating. It is a... there's not going to be a lot of explanation as far as what it is, but it's basically a thing that you can feed humans to. So then we come back to our friends, our two friends, two main characters, they're best friends, childhood best friends. One of them is an aspiring film director. He has not gone to film school. He can't afford it, but he really wants to be like the next Sam Raimi or someone like that who kind of worked his way in and got discovered by, although I think Sam Raimi did go to film school, but I can't remember. Anyway, but he wants to kind of make a film and break in that way and get noticed and in the 80s when there's all these horror movies, huge scene, and there's a lot of people wanting to break in. So I figure that's a realistic scenario. They're driving somewhere. Now, I've gone from this being a hunting lodge to being a rooming house, which I find is an interesting transition. But the reason I wanted it to be a hunting lodge is because I wanted it to be out remote in the middle of nowhere. But then I realized it doesn't really matter I don't think for that to happen. In fact, it might be a bigger threat if it is in the middle of a town somewhere. So I got rid of that idea. I'm not tying myself down to what kind of house. I would like it to be a rooming house. But anyway, they're on their way out. They stop at the gas station. They get a little bit of a warning from the same guy in Cabin of the Woods that gave those guys a warning. What do they call him again in Cabin of the Woods? They had a name. What? Harbinger?
Harbinger.
Yeah, so we have to have a Harbinger. For some reason, I have a vision and a goal of having this person be played by, what's his name? Joe Bob Briggs. I don't know why I want Joe Bob Briggs to play him. I don't know. I just love to have Joe Bob Briggs be a gas station attendant in this thing. And so so I have the opening gag, and this is going to be a spoiler. So this is going to be like the first moment, shock moment of the movie, where the main character is going to come out with his stuff, snacks or whatever for the road. He's going to get into the car, and there's going to be his friend splayed across the seat with his throat slit open and blood all over the place. He's dead. But he's not really dead because he's a special effects wizard and he just figured this out himself and just made himself look like his throat was slit. And it looks real. And his friend doesn't buy it for a second. He's like, no, I know you're okay. And he throws a pack of ho-hos and hits him in the face. So that's kind of the introduction to the characters.
That's like a good twist.
This one guy, this one guy is like, he's so into the special effects. He's very much, he's again, self-taught. So he's got all these kind of tricks that he's learned. And this is in the age before the internet. So he's reading magazines. He's doing research. He is like figuring out what's going on. And so he's also built himself kind of a creature that we're going to come back to, like he calls him Frank, which is like this, just the monster of the movie that they're making. So then they have this scene at the gas station. Then they continue on, and this is where I was going to have a montage. Jonathan doesn't like montages, so I think I may have cut the montages. But you make good points about, what was your thing about the montage again? I don't remember what it was.
There's no change that takes place during a montage typically. Is one thing, and therefore it's a very expensive way to do nothing, to accomplish nothing. It almost always gets cut in editing, but it costs so much to shoot it, and then it has typically no purpose. That can't be served by a single scene that's more interesting and dramatic and cheaper.
Yeah, so that's where I went with that. So I'll have a scene, whatever I wanted to accomplish. The montage was to solidify the friendship and to show how close they are and how like they really are there for each other. And so I will accomplish that with a scene.
Your throat slit does that, though.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, does it?
Yeah,
oh,
the throat slit is perfect because he's not pissed off.
Plus, it sets up the idea that people might get confused and think like these things are special effects.
Okay.
So it's got a great doubleness.
Okay, that's true. Okay,
there's a lot of things.
So then Billy Bob warns them off. We get a little bit of information about the boarding house and that it was shut down because of something that happened there. Like it was like, it's been, you know, abandoned for 20 years or
whatever. There was asbestos. Oh, I'm not supposed to have that idea.
Not asbestos. No, come on, man. That's so basic. Okay. No, but I mean, that would be an explanation. But that was something has happened and it's been shut down. And the gas station attendant gives them that information and they're off to go and shoot. And they've called all these people. All the people who are coming to make the movie with them are people they've reached out to through want ads and community groups. And it's not people they know. It's just people they've kind of recruited to come help them. And they're actors and they're all doing it for free. This is not like a paid legitimate movie shoot. These are kids doing it for fun and trying to figure it out. They think they can. They really think they can. So they show up, and then we are introduced to all the different characters. I'm not going to get into all the characters now, but we have, you know, we have a love interest for our main character. We have, she's also going to be the final girl in the movie they're making. They're making a movie within a movie. So we're going to see scenes from that. And so they begin making the film, and everything is going fine until something happens. And for some reason, I want something to happen to the sound guy. I feel like the sound guy's got to die first. I don't know why.
Maybe it's subconscious.
Maybe.
Because so many low-budget horror movies have horrible sound.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't think it even matters who dies first, but I'm struggling with how to have him die in a way. So this is kind of my first problem. Because Jonathan and I talked about having the main character, his motivation is that he wants to get this movie made no matter what. He's just going to, like, even though things are going to start going wrong and things are going to start happening, he is going to still want to have this movie made, and that is going to be his focus at the expense of others. So I want to have something happen to the sound guy to have him die. He's going to be the first victim to the meat house. But it has to happen in a way that the guy's got to be able to shrug it off. The main character's got to be able to shrug it off and rationalize continuing. And it can't just be he dies and he like hides the body, because that makes him seem like a bad person. So I don't know how to get there.
Well, the house has to eat the body too, right?
Yes.
So there's no body. I mean, I'm not sure. I think we had a half solution, which was that he explains it to the other people as this guy just took off.
Wait, are we breaking the rules now? Are we allowed to throw ideas now?
Yes.
Okay, here's my idea. The sound guy gets brutally injured enough that the sound guy says to the director, I gotta go. They have a blow up. The director says, well, we're making it without you then. And then he leaves, and all that blood awakens the meat house.
Okay.
And then he's killed, but the director does not know.
The director doesn't know, but the director does cause the death because he causes him to leave?
That's right.
Okay.
Well, he's been injured because of some shoddy filmmaking.
Because of something, yeah, something happened on set.
And then they're like, where did he go? And he said, well, he told me he's leaving. Where did he go? And now you show that he's so obsessed with the white whale of making the movie that he hasn't followed up to see if the guy's
okay. And then later, maybe the director discovers, like, somehow that the guy didn't go.
His sound equipment or something, yeah.
You ever seen one of these before?
Yeah, sure, every day. What is it?
This is my uncle's harpoon gun.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of Reservoir Dogs, right? The guy's bleeding out the stomach. We got to take him to the hospital. No, we're not going to.
Because, yeah, we robbed
the
bank.
We've got to do this bigger thing. In this case, the bigger thing is the movie, and the injury can't stop us from doing this bigger
thing. Okay, so I'm going to take a look at that. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so there's that. And then so what happens is the sound guy dies. He's the first kind of warning. They continue on, and I've kind of gotten rid of the idea of there being a secret room. That was something that we had talked about originally. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea. I don't want to have the trouble of having them find it and going through all that problem.
It was also one of our first ideas.
It was.
Which then became a darling. So this is a great example of first idea, worst idea,
I never
killing
liked
your darling.
Idea, so
okay.
I'm fine with it.
Okay. And so I figured that
I can use it in my version.
I figure that instead of that, let's just make like the central the den or wherever the fireplace would be in this place, like a big room, family mean common room, is going to be kind of the central point. And I want it to look like a face. Like there's going to be a chimney coming down with a fireplace and maybe some windows on the side, so it looks like a face. And so then the fireplace is going to be one way in which the meat house eats people, and also the toilet. And also any like orifice that you can think of in a house.
Trapdoor.
That's great.
Trapdoors is everything. And it's going to be, I haven't quite visualized the method of eating, but I imagine tendrils of some kind coming out and it's like grabbing on and pulling people in or something. I don't know. I haven't quite gotten that. But there is a caretaker. I do like the idea of there being a person there to kind of rent them the house, warn them of certain things. Don't do this. Don't do that. Whatever. You know, don't go out to the top floor or whatever because there's something up there. And then is basically working on trying to find a way to feed them to the meat house to wake it up again. And then once they feed the first one to the meat house, it wakes up and starts going crazy. And then we get into the transformation of it.
All right. Are you still running through the whole plot right
now? No. Yeah. Yes, I am. Because they get into so I have to skip over. So this is the part is you have to skip over the things you haven't thought of yet. Hey?
Yeah. But just do that.
Okay. So I'm just going to skip over that. So I'm going to skip to the part where they get to the big reveal and they've learned that this is a meat house and they have like it's transforming into flesh. They get separated. They can't go out the front door for some reason. I don't know. How do we answer this question in horror movies? They can never go out the front door because then
the meat
would
house would just close the doors. Like,
right. The meat house is like grow. The flesh grows over. Like there is going to be a visual a thing where the walls are going to become flesh. The whole thing is going to become meat because it's eating people and that's what feeds it and it absorbs it and kind of thing. So then they get separated. They split into two parties. One of them goes into a room that becomes the mimic room, which I've talked about, which is it starts to like the face gets pressed against it and then it starts to like create its own little face on the walls and then it starts mimicking their body parts and kind of like trying to become them. And so there's that.
Another, so can I ask a question here? So is that a setup for the idea later that the caretaker is actually not a caretaker? He's been mimicked in the past. He's an appendage of the meat house?
Yes, that's the idea behind that. So and the idea is that the meat house is actually mimicking what it's been fed. So there will be rooms that have things to do with like animals. Like it's been fed deer, it's been fed bears. So there are things in there that will be like related to that.
So the meat house, though, just to be clear in my head, this caretaker is the meat
house. Is a part of the meat house.
It just seems like he's the guy controlling it or whatever, but he's actually the meat house.
Yes. He's the bulb, the light up bulb on the lantern fish.
We talked about being, he doesn't need to be physically connected to it.
Right.
Like, let's just, because we talked about there being somewhere like.
Yes, he does.
I don't know.
I think he does.
Do you think so?
Yes, he does.
How's he 100%. Physically connected? Okay. We're going to have to figure out a way to hide it then.
He walks with a limp and the umbilicus, we solved it already.
You don't have to. No, it's just reveal at a certain point that the meat house has been mimicking him or whatever.
Since we're off track.
He's always going to be on the ground.
Right. Here's and we're probably just going to show him from the waist up anyway, right?
Here's how you can close the front door. Okay. Imagine that the room is inside. Is like a separate area inside a fleshy wall.
Is that a mimic room now?
No, just the walls of the house itself internally. And it can turn the interior separate from the exterior, so now the walls don't line up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it could flex, and now the door slides, and now the meat is blocking it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right? Yeah.
And then you could just have it.
So pivot. Have you guys seen the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie, the newest one?
Yeah.
It's so funny how these ideas can pop up, because there's a scene in that where they go to the space station that's made out of meat. Do you remember that?
Yeah, that's right. And all the orifices.
It's like, this is the exact same thing. This is exactly what I was thinking of when I think of the walls of the meat house. I wanted it to look like that. I'm like, thank you, James Gunn, for showing me that.
But that answers my question. So just, you continue.
Yes, yes. So that is true. That it is part of the meat house, and it is trying to just basically
stop giving ideas.
No. He's just clarifying. That's clarifying. That is part of it.
He had three versions of it.
I had a version where it was like a grandson of a... person who started it. I don't want to get into it. In fact, I don't know how much I need.
Maybe
to get into
it. Maybe he was at one point, but now he's mimicked. That guy's been fit in meat house. He's mimicked it, whatever.
Yes, yes.
It turns out this guy you think is just a guy is actually part of the meat
yes,
house.
Yes, that's right.
I think that's a great
I think so movement. Too. So they get separated. There's a series of rooms, and we can cut back and forth between the two parties and what's happening, and I don't want to get too like boring or whatever, repetitive, but I do want them to kind of have like, oh my god, got to escape this room and get into this room and get out of this one. So there's gonna be a couple of those, and I still have I'm working out the details of the rooms, and then at the end my idea is that they have to come back down. They end up back down in the where the fireplace is. They have this, and this is where I'm kind of like, and this is, I know this is why endings aren't great in these things, but I want to have this creature that he's created, Frank, this big whatever it is, it's some kind of a animatronic creature. I have this joke, and this comes from Steve, where he was talking about, remember when he's talking about sliming things up?
Yeah.
He's saying like people are always disappointed when he comes to set with his monsters and they're not slimed up, and they're like, that's it? That's what I'm going to have happen in this. Like, he's going to bring Frank out, and people are going to be like, that's it? And he's like, I got to slime him up. So he's going to get all worked up about that. But this Frank is also rigged to explode. Frank is like, at the end of the movie, they were planning to have Frank blow and be a big spectacle. So he's got it already set up. He's got it set up with explosives. So at the end, they're just going to shove Frank in the fireplace and blow it up. And that's going to kill the meat house. That's what I have for my
story. So then that's the conversation.
Yeah, I like that.
Nez's idea. Sorry, I'm breaking the rules.
That's okay.
This is the conversation that they're having, arguing about as the car is pulling up in the beginning. The special effects guy and the director. How big is the explosion? Are you sure it's going to be big enough? Oh, yeah, it's big enough, I promise. Well, this is all new to you, too. Well, you've never directed anything. Don't talk to me. He goes in. He comes out. The guy's got his throat slit. And he's like, see, I'm good at this.
You're mixing up the scenes.
Right?
But I see what you're saying. But you could have an argument where it's like he takes out explosives because it can't be too big or whatever.
Yeah.
But the idea that we got these extra explosives, we can just put them in Frank. We can make it bigger.
And now they're stuffing it back in Frank to make it
bigger. Yeah. But then at the they're going to stick Frank in a corner and forget about him for most of the movie.
Yeah, and then they got to go back to him.
Yeah, and they're going back. Oh, and then there he is, and they'll just shove him. They'll figure out a way to
and
shove
it could
him
be.
I like the idea too of you can have a weekend with Bernie's kind of thing where they're trying to get Frank down the stairs.
Yeah, well,
I do feel like he's like a mannequin. It's not like a big blob monster or anything. It is like a Frankensteinish mannequin.
Yeah, but he'd be
mannequin.
Like dead weight. Like,
yeah. He'd be the dead weight.
Here's what's great about that is that
if
the old caretaker used to feed it dead deer and dead bears, while throwing in this dead human-looking thing makes sense.
Right.
That's the bait. They'll take the bait, and the meat house will eat it.
Yeah,
and then it'll kill it. There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't feel as bad about that. I thought that was kind of a lame idea.
Yeah, I like that. That's actually, I think, a really clever approach to it.
Thank you.
I tried to call, but there was no answer. I was worried about you, Roger.
Here's what I would say, Dan, at this point. You tell me what you think, Gregory. What I would say is you don't have... So there's two ways to approach writing a movie at this point. One is you really perfect this. Normally what you do in a scenario where I've hired you to write the meat house is you would get this more figured out. You'd get to a prose treatment together. It would really get dialed in 100% in this prose treatment. Now the reason for that is because I'm paying you for the treatment. I may fire you and hire someone else to write the movie.
Yeah.
But because that's not the scenario, like you haven't been hired to write meat house, you've got an option that you wouldn't normally have here, which is just I don't have it all figured out, but I'm gonna jump ahead and start writing scenes and just figure out the rest as I go. So I might suggest that. I might suggest you've got enough here, I think, figured out that you could just start writing the scenes you have figured out. Because again, you can write these things out of order.
Yep.
Don't worry about how they really match. Just try to get the scene working. Can I get the scene to work? Can I get this scene to work? Can I get this scene to work? Just jumping around at whatever you can get to work. And then later on, when you've gotten a lot of scenes kind of drafted here, you can start sort of ordering them a bit more and kind of just seeing, okay, well, what's the missing connective tissue? what do I really need in terms of connecting these scenes? What do I have already? What do I really need? And what, like, maybe has to change in the scenes now that they're kind of leading into one another?
Yeah,
that's one way to approach it. Like, I might at this point be tempted to jump ahead and really start writing scenes because I feel like you've got enough good stuff figured out. It seems dialed in enough to me that you could probably get further faster by actually drafting scenes.
Okay.
And then start to connect the missing gaps.
Writing some new stuff might come to me, right?
Yes. Writing the scenes will create the if this, then that approach.
Yeah.
Which will help you with character.
Yeah.
Right? If this guy's a jerk and that's the reason that they aren't doing this, now you have these motivations. Well, now how do I show this character trait in the next scene and the next scene and the next scene? And if I'm hoping that they'll learn their lesson, what is the thing that is in the plot that will inform character?
Now, the downside, though, is you won't have as much to go on and you won't have as much of a map in writing those scenes. So it'll be harder to write these scenes than it would be if you had it all figured out. But I mean, I don't know which one would be better for you, I guess. Like, for me, I would jump ahead to this point to writing the scenes. I would try kind of just trust myself to figure out the rest of it. I've got all the big things figured out. Like, to me, it's like the big rocks are in place. Yeah, I don't know exactly, like, what this girl has to do or what the movie-to-movie means or is going to matter or what it's going to look like. But I could maybe figure that out because I would just write the big rocks of the Meat House plot. Then I'd mirror them or prefigure them in the movie in a movie scene plot, for example. So like I wouldn't, like, to me, like I'm uncomfortable with patchworking it at this point. But if you're not, you would want to do the other more standard thing. It's up to you.
I think because I haven't
really... I think you got the big rocks, though.
Yeah, I haven't really... I'm ready to jump in, I think. I just need motivation and time and focus. I think I've got enough of it figured out that I can start. I can certainly keep working on, like, the cards. We were talking about cards in previous episodes and writing down the change that happens in each scene and having that in mind. I think that's important, right, to have that in mind when you're writing the scenes.
I do it before you write the scene.
Yeah. But have that in place before I write the scene. But do that for as many scenes as I can. And if I don't have them all, that's okay. I just do them for what I have, and then hope, and I can find the rest of it. But because I'm not being paid to do this, and nobody's depending on me, I'm in a good position to do this in the way I want to do it, right?
Yeah, in the way that you is going to keep you interested.
Yeah, and keep me motivated to write. Yeah.
So a fun exercise, since the goal here is to learn about the craft of making these stories, a really fun exercise can be to write your first scene and write your last scene and have them be echoes of each other.
Uh-oh.
Like rewrite scene one and the final scene of your movie so that they contain a number of thematic elements that connect to each other. One way to think of it is that the first sentence of a novel can contain the entire story of the novel. If you the small piece is also reflected in the big piece.
I agree with everything he's
just
saying.
Just as an example, as a challenge.
I would personally suggest you don't do that, and instead, first just write the scene that in your head is the clearest.
Okay. I've already written a couple
scenes.
I've already written a few scenes. That was the gas station scene. That was the clearest one that I wrote. I've already written it. That was the one with the throat slit one. Yeah, that was the best one, I thought. But it was like,
and it's a good scene.
Yeah.
We both responded to it.
Yeah, I think so. Even better if I can get Joe Bob.
Sure. Then maybe jump ahead to the scenes.
I mean, I think it's interesting to think about. Like, I didn't even consider doing that, so I'm gonna think and see how can I do that. How can I? Because it is very satisfying when that happens, when it comes back around at the end.
And you may find that is not the right tool.
Maybe it's not.
And so this is what I'm saying. Since you're not working on deadline and you're not trying to please somebody else, please yourself as a person learning skills.
Yeah.
So look at the total structure of your story and say, can I make the first scene and the last scene connect to one another really strongly? If that doesn't work later, you're if this then that, fine, you're not on anyone's deadline.
And again, I kind of 100% agree with what you're saying, but my advice would be focus on establishing a schedule of writing, and so every time you sit down, just write the thing you're most excited to write.
Okay.
And don't worry so much about whether it's a good idea to write this thing right now, but focus on the motivating yourself to sit down and write on a schedule.
Okay.
And so I would say spend a couple weeks just, you sit down, you just write whatever you feel like, whatever you're excited to write today, A little bit later, you're going to have to get away from that.
Yeah.
And it becomes a bit more of a work project. But if you can kind of ingrain the schedule of it and the habit of it first, like to me, that's the, even if it's just 5 minutes, you know, I'm going to sit down at 10 a.m. for 5 minutes to write Meat House. What I want to write, I got a funny joke idea. I'm just going to write that joke. Like,
yeah.
Even, like right now, I think the thing you got to get is the habit and the schedule ingrained. And then you can ladder it up to like, okay, what's actually going to be the most effective way to work?
Right.
Yeah, let's put you to the fire now.
Well, that was my next thing.
Where do you write this most often?
I'm going to write it here, actually, if it's okay. I need a space. I don't have a space at home. I can't. I tried at home.
Sylvia Plath, Room of One's Own, right?
I've tried.
Is that right?
What's that?
A Room of One's Own.
This isn't one of those places where you guys own part of the intellectual rights of things that are created in
here. No, not at all. No, this is not work for hire.
It should be.
I just feel I need it because I come here every week on Thursday now. This is our day to record. And I definitely have a couple hours now on a Thursday afternoon to just hang out here and just keep typing and keep working on it. So I'm going to try and do that for the next couple weeks.
Virginia Woolf. That's who I'm thinking of. A Room of One's Own. You need
money in a room of one's own. A woman needs money in a room of one's own to write.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't have money.
In this case, you don't need either of those things.
Okay. I have a room for you.
You do.
Yeah. If you're Virginia, but the notion here being that if you have a place, which you know is a place for you to work, and you have a time set aside to work, and when the door is shut, quote unquote, on that time for you, then the rest is academic.
Realistically, what you're writing at this point doesn't really matter so much.
Woman lived here before you was nuts. Wouldn't be surprised if someone just got fed up and offered her.
She was my aunt.
Heart of gold, though.
While Gregory's correct 100%, I suspect you probably need a couple weeks to get to the point where you're doing intentional work on
good
particular
stuff will come
things.
Yeah, well, I just want to start. Like, we're going to start like today. I'm going to sit here and
just
do some stuff on
right
it.
Now.
And then every week after we finish recording, I will continue to do that. I have tried. I do like writing in. I've written in like Tim Hortons and stuff like that over the last little while. I just haven't had time to do it. And I definitely don't like writing at home. Definitely found that.
Make it easy and make it fun.
Yes.
The big thing of a schedule or like anything like where you're trying to get into the habit of it is you got to remove the friction that's preventing. So one, like figure out like what are the things that are preventing me from writing. Like one of the reasons I bought a laptop I won an award years ago and it was like
humble
a big chunk of money. And I thought it was for being the most promising writing.
Yeah, right? Promising. That's right.
So
why are you laughing?
Me and Dave Robertson have
that's
a joke about it. That like he won this award, and then I won it or something. And I was like joking to him, like Dave, you've done so many things already. Like you're the most promising writer. And he's like, he goes, his joke was great. He goes, yeah, I make a lot of promises. He's like, I make the most promises. He goes, it doesn't mean I fulfill any of them or keep them.
That's good.
But our joke kind of became like that. We were like, we were promising in the sense that like, we actually like just had all this potential we weren't using. but I thought to myself when I won that award, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this cash, and instead of doing what I would normally do with it, like just pay my bills or whatever, I'm going to actually just spend it on something that will help me fulfill my promise. Mm-hmm. So I bought a laptop, and it sounds ridiculous when I say this, but I bought a laptop, which I never owned a laptop, because I was like, then I can take this to different locations, and when I open it and press the button to turn it on, it'll turn on quickly. Though I realized those two things are preventing me from writing.
Really?
The computer wasn't turning on fast enough, and I had to keep waiting for it to turn on. So I would like turn it on. I had an idea. I'd turn on the computer, and I would sit there and wait. You know, it would just take too long to turn on, and I would get distracted and go do something else.
And I was decoding why I like working in public places sometimes for writing prose. Yep. I like to go do some drafting where all the noise is. But when I really think about it, what I'm actually after, if I go into the subconscious thing, I think I like walking towards where I'm going to be working so that I have a little bit of lead time of like sorting in my head what it is I'm going to be working on. And then when I get there, no one is asking me an important question of any kind. You know, is it just for one? Yes. What would you like?
Cream and sugar.
Yeah, cream and sugar. There are no important, nothing that requires actual.
Yeah.
If I go home or sometimes if I arrive here, there are important questions being fired at me immediately that derail the creative decision I have made.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're coming here,
nobody's asking me questions here,
right? We ask you important questions about the podcast, but when that's done, right, that time will be your own.
Yeah.
And we'll,
when my daughter was in high school, she was a hard time just buckling down and writing essays and things. I made a deal with her, which was if she ever went to a coffee shop and didn't bring her phone with her, or at least, you know, if she ever wanted to study, she could just go to like a coffee shop and I'd take my credit card and buy whatever she wanted. She could buy whatever she wanted at McNally or the coffee shop or whatever, as long as like she was there to study. Mm-hmm. So then she got like, again, she just kind of got a reward for doing it. You know?
Yep.
So in some ways, you got to almost reward yourself.
Well, like, not everyone's in the position to pay someone else to develop good habits. But a good way to develop a good habit in your case is, you've already said, you asked us before, you said, you know, is it okay if I use the space mm-hmm. after we do the recording to do some other work? And of course,
anything you
yes.
can do to like create the trigger or do the reward system. It's Pavlov's dogs, right?
Yeah.
It's like you need to just train yourself like a dog with rewards and punishments to do the thing.
Yeah, and it's my hope that I do really want to, once I get started, really want to try and write this quickly and like draft it quickly, and I'm going to do that during NaNoWriMo because it's coming up.
So
I want to write every day. I'm going to try and write something every day during the month of November.
And David Robertson, if he was here, would say something that I've heard him say a number of times, I'm sure, which is you just do the math. If it's a 100,000 words and you want to write it in 100 days, you write 1,000 words a day. Like he would just say, break it down. I've heard him give the advice to people. It's like, someone asked him once in front of me, like, how do you write so much whatever? He's like, well, just figure out how much you got to do write every day, and then I write that much a day.
Yeah.
And on some level, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But in a certain objective way, it's not.
Yeah, because you are, you're like a person panning for gold, right? That's the editing process at the end.
Yeah.
But first you have to find the river, right? And fill it with stones.
And sift it.
And the sifting is later. So having a writing schedule is the equivalent of the river is there when you need it.
Well, and it gets to two is like, well, what's keeping you away from the river? Is it that you need a jacket? Is it that you don't know how to swim? Is it that, you know, it's you wish you had... you need gas in your car. Like, so there's like the level of like, what's stopping you from doing it? Let's just remove all that friction as much as possible. So leaving your house and coming here is like an example. That's why I come here.
Yep.
Right? It's exactly what you were saying. Like, if I'm at home, people walk in the office, they ask me to do something.
And these are your family members, so they're important
questions.
Enough.
Yep.
Yeah, and I'm there, fair enough. Yeah. Technically, I can do this thing I'm doing later.
Yeah,
they're not wrong, but you know, if I just move here, then they don't have the temptation, you know, of that, and I don't have the distraction of Zelda, you know, like so. There's like whatever is stopping you from doing it. If you can just get that out of your way.
Lately, my distraction is Dad. Can you help me with long division?
Yeah,
God,
and fair enough. It's more important.
It is more important.
Help
your kid with their long division.
But also, if you're not around, like, you know, there's like a, you know, you don't want to get to the extreme of it.
Yeah, right.
Whereas, like, you train the kid not to ask you.
Exactly. Can't do that.
But I think that
take the temptation
focus time here every week will help. So let's check back in like a month, and after a month of me doing that, and we'll see where I'm at.
Balzac used to have his servants take his clothes. He would be in his. He would be naked. He couldn't leave the house. They weren't allowed to give them back to him unless he'd written so many words.
Again, let's just put some context here. His servants.
Balzac invented realism.
Right?
There we go.
So if you have servants, dear listener, and they can take your clothes away, that'll help your writing process. If, like the rest of us poor plebeians, you have to rely on
but the point is anything.
Your own self-discipline, a good solution here is find a place where you're not supposed to leave until you have accomplished something.
Right.
You should never rely on your own self-discipline, is my point.
Yeah.
You should create an engineer a system like I'm here, so therefore I'm not there. No one can ask me and distract me, whatever.
Okay. What I like
something
is,
more fun to do.
I think if you listen closely to the playback of this episode, you will see that.
I agree with you.
Neither Jonathan nor I are agreeing with each other's methods.
That never happens, though.
No, but, here's a...
Well,
this
because
is an
methods
important...
are different.
Yes,
from person.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
So I like that. I don't care.
When you find what's working, you'll have the result to prove that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Then you ask yourself, oh, I love that page. Don't go, pat yourself on the back, say, what happened today that allowed this page to exist in this mm-hmm. form that I'm proud of and happy with? And then try to recreate the steps of that process, because it's like wag the dog. You know, you're talking about Pavlov, yeah. right? You need the tail to wag the dog in this case. So you need to go backwards and say, okay, well, it turned out I was in a rush this morning to run for the bus, right? Well, maybe rushing and getting up and going is actually a good part of your mental process that gets the other creative juices flowing. You don't know yet until you repeat the process. Use the scientific method. Now you have the result, mm-hmm. repeat the experiment. See if the result is the same. Repeat the experiment. If the result is the same, now you have something you can rely on. Oh, this is how I work. That's why I am so passionate about describing my method, because I've used it over and over and over to produce the same results, and therefore it's reliable for me. Jonathan, the same way. For him, these are the things that produce results for him. You're going to find that yourself.
Yeah.
And you're going to suffer soon as a result.
For me, I find it often is more about, I can really write under any conditions, but what I find is I stop myself more than needing something to start.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's interesting when I write.
Can you write upon a train? Can you write in the rain?
I tried writing on the bus and I couldn't do it on the bus. I when I write in
Chadwick
articles,
really writes on the bus all
does.
The time.
Yeah,
Chadwick Ginther,
for some
yeah.
people, that's the thing. You know, you got to kind of figure out what your thing is.
Think you're funny, Roger? A few years ago, you had a chance to kill me. Now I'm going to kill your little boy unless you kill yourself.
No!
Daddy!
But when I write articles for CTV, I will just like blow through that so quick. Like I'm just regurgitating information in a better way. That's kind of what I'm like, taking all this other stuff.
So
in
your draft, right? Once you have a rough draft, you'll be regurgitating information that you take for granted as being correct
right.
into your second draft. Yeah. And that's why when people talk about like writing being easy, it's not easy. It's like you just said, oh, I can write off those articles. I would struggle with that. Right, yeah. Because I don't have that method.
It can be easy. Yeah. Like what I realized when I write articles, like if I do a book review or an article, I will. What I realized eventually was what was stopping me was I was doing. Basically, I was being too perfectionist with it.
Yeah.
So the rule I made was I start writing it, I finish writing it, I submit it, I don't read it again. I don't even edit it once.
Oh, okay. I usually do one pass.
I don't even do one pass anymore.
No.
Now, I have learned, though, how to write a perfect article front to back.
I was going to say.
Yeah, over doing it enough times, you really get it.
If I sent my first
and I don't really need to edit it.
Yeah.
They would never invite me back. Whereas Jonathan can send a first
but
draft.
I build the draft slowly and I get it done. And but then I'm not, you know, I just do it quick. But I can't do that for fiction, I've learned. I can't do it for poetry. I got to do almost the reverse process. I got to write fast, not slow. I got to edit it like crazy, not just, you know, send it off without editing. Like, so it starts to become real particular.
Yeah. I find that, I lost my train of thought and I can't remember what I was going to say about that. Never mind.
My train of thought is still boarding at the station.
Yeah.
All right, what else?
But I think we're both saying the same thing. You know, do some experiments to see what's working for you. Your sort of big principles to me are figure out what's stopping you and focus on removing those things. Figure out what's helping you and focus on intensifying those things. It seems like you got a good handle on what you would do. I would caution you initially to just focus on getting the schedule in place and what's going to help you in place. Just do things that are exciting to you and that help you get started. After a couple of weeks, you know, get onto the more focused hard work train, and the kind of thing Gregory is saying is a perfect example of the kind of thing that I would maybe do then.
Yeah.
But so you could do it earlier.
There's another piece of advice that I received at one point is to pick a story that you know well, or a type of story that you know really well. So you have a Star Wars podcast.
I do.
And you and I both talk about Star Trek all the time. You know those things. Imagine if, maybe the next time you're riding the bus, imagine if the away team from Next Generation found the meat house.
Yeah.
What are the questions they would ask? What are the ways they would explore it? All of those things will go through your head, because you know what Dana Troy, she can sense the feelings of this creature, but it's so hungry and it's so alone and it's, you know, all these things. Because what you've got going for you, if you apply a story you love to a story you're writing, is you have a way to think about it that's outside of your own writing process. Someone else established those rules that now you're following because you're a fan of it.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm not saying rewrite it as a Star Trek episode.
No, but I like
I'm
that because
think about it as
I like that you said Star Trek because, you know, with this type of a movie, people automatically would suggest Cabin in the Woods or something similar, but that's not what I want. That's not I don't want another Cabin in the Woods movie. Right? That's not what this is going
to
be.
Let me make a final suggestion too before I need to take off, which is I've got an episode.
Your clothes and hand them to your servants.
One of the episodes of my podcast that I've got coming out is me talking about Dan O'Bannon's book, where he discusses what he calls dynamic structure. And I kind of, I think that'd be a really good episode for you to listen to. But it boils down to this question, which is maybe think a little bit at some point, set some time aside to think about from the meat house's point of view. What are its objectives and goals and obstacles? Because in many ways, the O'Bannon who wrote Alien, like the O'Bannon's method of screenwriting, I think is a really brilliant approach fundamentally that I don't see enough where he really talks about, you know, the best movies for him are an antagonist and a protagonist, or really two antagonists against one another.
Mm-hmm.
From the protagonist, we're so used to thinking about the protagonist's point of view, like what is this person trying to accomplish and what's stopping them. O'Bannon says, you know, it really helps to think about the antagonist has a goal. What is, imagine almost reversing the roles a bit. What if we were following the meat house and the meat house was our figure who's got a goal and is trying to accomplish the goal? Now the whole thing gets framed in terms of, in structural terms, in terms of like how, like, okay, this guy's trying to do something, but then the meat house tries to do something. Like, they've got opposing goals.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of in a conflict. What you get when you kind of think that way a bit more fully is, you get a more complex monster that is in many ways a worse monster, because it's, you start to think a bit more about it as a character and less as like a environmental force, say.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts to give some dimension to the story's plot on that kind of character level. But also, it just is a really interesting way to really focus the plot, and you get rid of a lot of extraneous aspects. I would say that I've never seen an approach to plotting a movie specifically that's better than O'Bannon's. Unfortunately, he died before he finished writing the book, so it's not super fleshed out, but I think that podcast that's coming up on my podcast, I think I do a good job of kind of walking through what his idea is.
Okay.
Thinking it from the standpoint of the villain or the monster or the antagonist is a good method. The best example of that, so I'm a big fan, just because of my Scandinavian side of the family, of the epic poem Beowulf, written recorded sometime in the year 900 or so.
Yeah.
And Beowulf, for those of you who don't know, very simply, a group of warriors arrive and they need to help a struggling kingdom because a monster is bothering them, right?
It's like a dragon story kind
right?
of thing.
Well, the dragon comes later.
Yep.
But John Gardner wrote a novel called Grendel, which is from the perspective of the monster, who is just trying to live his natural life in the quiet wilderness, and all these noisy humans come and start building a settlement and start hunting the game and start hurting his people. And now he's got to do something about it. Like, he doesn't want to, but he's got to go try and do something about it.
Right.
And so when you look at it from that perspective, you start to see the plot of Beowulf much differently.
And it's an interesting way to just sort of get another take on your idea as you're kind of fleshing out a scene, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I find it can help you sort of fill in a hole, like where you've got, like, I'm not really sure what to do here. It's like, well, what is the meat house trying to do?
Right.
Like, maybe you don't know what the character is trying to do here or should be trying to do, but what's the meat house trying to do? Because the character will have to react to that.
Yeah.
So because you can think
right
about
now,
it in two different ways. It's action reaction, right?
So far in the breakdown, your creature hides and eats, but its picks a very specific camouflage, right, to look like a dwelling. So the question in your notion of the creature's biology, which does not have to, by the way, appear as a function of the plot of the story whatsoever. But if you decide for yourself, why does it look like a house? Its motivations will become more apparent to you, and therefore the sinister actions it takes in the terms of your plot will become more useful to you.
Okay.
Yeah, so I won't worry too much about this at this point, but I think as you're kind of getting into scenes and getting into drafting, this is a great sort of, I find it a really great exercise in perspective to kind of start to add just that extra level of dimension and interest and like really up the kind of level of what you're doing.
Yeah, if you think about it in terms of the famous flesh eaters of novels and cinema, Hannibal the cannibal, Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
Who does he eat?
Hannibal, alien.
Who does he eat?
No, no, who does
Thanos.
He eat?
He doesn't eat anybody.
Yeah, no. Hannibal eats a very specific type of person. He doesn't just eat people.
Oh, he eats serial killers.
No.
Right? No?
He eats the rude.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Is that what he eats? Okay.
Yeah.
I never picked that up.
Right? If people are rude and crass.
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
Yeah.
If they're in a certain level of society and they are crass, well, they deserve to be served.
So
to
why
the rest
does it? Why does the meat house kill? The, like, what is it?
Yeah.
And it has to be more than just sustenance, right? It has to be more than just like.
Otherwise, it'd have been found out. There has to be a level of subtlety to what it's doing.
Okay.
Again, you may not need to know this right now, but I think as you're kind of writing and revising, to have like in your the back of your mind a bit more about what is this going to make this meat house a great monster, as opposed to just like the monster we've got.
Okay. Cool.
Like, Alien is a great monster, but the creatures from Leviathan, the Alien ripoff movie, aren't that great. You know?
And it does really come down to that alien, I think, being this mother figure, and it has this drive to live. You can understand its drive to live is the same as their drive to live. It's better. It's a perfect organism, as you know, the one character says.
Yep.
Because it doesn't have any of these other things that are preventing them from living and just fulfilling their drive to live. They've got all these power struggles and anxieties and whatever. The alien is just moving forward endlessly.
Like a great...
And that's what makes it terrifying.
A great... So we've brought this up on the show before. Susie Maloney has a great way of saying, why this, why now? For structuring your story.
Yeah.
So what if the reason that the meat house is happening now was because its camouflage is failing? Maybe when you're finished watching the movie, a careful observer realizes, oh, does that mean there are a lot of these creatures and they've just never been discovered because they're too good at their camouflage?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. The mimic from D&D vibes, right?
Again, who knows, but like just as something to throw in the mix when you're kind of thinking about the meat house on your walks to the studio or what have you.
Well, I'll be thinking about it here every week, and I'll do it on the bus. I think that's something I can do on the bus, is definitely visualize meat house.
Perfect.
So we'll go from there.
This has been Super Pulp Science, where we have been visiting with a story already in progress and talking about the who's, hows, and whys of getting your own creative process under your own control. I am Gregory Kamichuk, encouraging you all to join the fight and make comics.